Hi.
Hi. So, what's this book about?
You didn't read this one either?
Well, I was gonna, but I accidentally read something else.
What?
Vogue.
I hated the book, all right? I have no idea what it's about, and the writer was clearly on drugs when he wrote it. I mean, it went on and on and on like it was written in a total hurry. If I handed in something like this, there's no way I'd get a good grade on it. I mean, it's boring and it's unorganized. And I only read 30 pages of it anyway.
Well, that was passionate, albeit entirely misinformed.
Who dares follow Miss Kelly's lucid analysis?
It's required reading.
With Tom and Stella.
Episode number 89, Alas Babylon by Pat Frank.
That's great. It starts with an earthquake. Birds and snakes and airplane. And Lenny Bruce is not afraid. I have a hurricane. Listen to yourself. Churn world serves its own needs. Dummy serve your own needs. Feed it up an ox. Speak grunt. No strength. The ladder starts to clatter with fear. Bite down. High wire and a fire. Representing seven games in a government for hire and a combat site. Left the West coming in a hurry with the Furies breathing down your neck. Team my team reporters.
Hello and welcome to Required Reading with Tom and Stella, a podcast brought to you by the Two True Freaks Internet Radio Network. This podcast is all about books, literature, radioactive material, scavenging, and also vigilantism. And each month we take a thorough look at some book that we found in the library that's luckily still open to us, even though catastrophe has struck our country. And while we determine whether it is in fact worth our time or whether we should be catching quail or fishing or going and getting some salt. So I am here. Luckily, radioactive material, the fallout is kind of far away from us, and I ran to get my good friend Tom because sometimes I just worry about whether he can take care of himself, so I'm here to protect him. So Tom, welcome. Welcome to my bunker.
Wow, such faith in me. The price of salt in this novel is very high.
Oh, yes.
See what I did there?
I did like what you did there.
Hi.
I'm excited to talk about this with you. It's a step down memory lane for me.
Mm-hmm.
But I felt like also this is a relevant novel to our current state, maybe. I mean, I don't want to fear monger, but hey, it could happen.
I was actually saw somebody on – I follow somebody on TikTok who – I think her name is Colette or Claudette or something, and she does the Gen X updates. She's hilarious, and she did this whole thing about how we're all like in more danger than in nuclear war than we have been in decades. And then I once for the fifth time in like a year deleted TikTok from my phone because I was spending too much time in it again. So, but I was just like, yeah, no, I'm right there with you. There is a legitimate fear out there. So
yeah, absolutely. And this guy was pretty. Yeah, Frank was prescient in terms of what could happen and mm-hmm. is pretty scientific about it, but we'll talk about all of that for sure. What is your history with this book?
I had actually never heard of this book until you chose it for the show. So I was actually really curious because if anybody who's listened to my other podcast, Pop Culture Affidavit, has been following me for a while, about 3 or 4 years ago, I think it was, it was from 2019 to 2021. I did a miniseries called Fallen Walls, Open Curtains. That was about 30 years since the end of the Cold War. And so I did, you know, what was going on at the time in 89 through 91, and then historical things, pop culture about the Cold War. And I did an episode, I think Mike Bailey was on it with me, where we went over 1980s era nuclear Holocaust films, specifically The Day After, which is the very famous TV movie from 1983, Testament, which is was a PBS production but was released into theaters around in the same year, and then the BBC production of Threads. And we talked about those three and the fear-mongering of the era of that early 80s, and how we really were concerned that the Russians and us were going to drop the bomb at, you know, any given moment. So this is the type of speculative fiction that I've always enjoyed, in a ironic sort of, not ironically, but like, it's kind of ironic that I enjoy something that is full of, like, you know, death, but I've always, enjoyed this sort of fiction because I find it fascinating and terrifying. So I was looking forward to reading this when you suggested it.
Glad to hear it. And let me first say that even though I'm contractually obligated because I am Tom's co-hosting little sister and his friend, I will say that that miniseries was really good. And so you can either believe it because I'm telling you, or you can believe it by the fact that I don't normally listen to his show just because I don't have a lot of time. But both that series and then the 9/11 series I downloaded. Mm. And I think on every episode or like every two, I was like commenting and emailing and stuff. So I do highly recommend going out and getting those.
Thank you.
Of course. And my history with it, I read this in my freshman year high school English class.
Wow.
Yes. And so I really liked it when we read it, and I kept thinking, I've recommended it to other people along the way. I remember I had a friend who really liked the Jericho TV series.
I remember that.
Yeah. And so I was like, oh, well, if you like that, you should read A Last Babylon. And it was, you know, generally, I think people enjoy when I recommend this, they enjoy that. And I was thinking about rereading it. Yeah. So I thought, well, you know, why not? Why not do this? Because like I said, we were talking about kind of apocalyptic stuff through St. John Mandel. Mm-hmm. And I thought, well, that one that didn't pan out because of the author, but this one, let's go back through memory lane. And then I wondered as I was reading, I'm like, it seems familiar, but also was I wrong? But because I kept thinking about irradiated gold and it wasn't happening, but then the scene happens, I'm like, oh, thank goodness it was this book, because I just always remembered that particular scene. So I'm glad that I reread it, and I'm glad that I offered it to you. I guess we'll find out whether you found it worthwhile.
You mentioned Jericho. There was another series in the mid to the 2010s, I think it was, called Revolution.
And the premise, yes, on NBC. Show.
Yeah, the premise was that all of the electricity and power and mechanical power went out. There was this giant EMP that wiped it all out. And it, like, the first episode, you know, and so it's like 10 or 15 years later. And there's this whole, you know, we see like what the society's become, and there's a MacGuffin in there. And I remember I watched like the first half of the first season or something, and I keep meaning to go back and see if I can watch it somewhere, because I remember really liking it. But they kept flashing back, kind of, because this was around the time Lost was sort of the thing that people were trying to chase as far as like a series. So they would always flash back to something involving one of the characters from either the before time or the early days of the disaster. And it had some really good performances. It was Giancarlo Esposito naturally played a villain character.
That poor man.
But his origin episode, where like we see the story arc, like his arc begin, is really good. And so I would recommend tracking that down. And for all I know, it's on Peacock and it's behind a paywall, which I already pay you enough, Comcast, when you kid me. But anyway.
Yeah.
Since I do recommend Revolution. It was just, it's not like perfect television.
Yeah.
You know, but it was fun, and it's fun speculative stuff. So it's worth the watch.
Yeah, I think I tried to give it a shot, but I felt like they were making the lead teenage female character too Katniss-like. Because she had like a bone arrow and everything.
They were definitely going for that.
I can't take this right now. Yeah. So maybe if I give it a shot now far enough away. I will also recommend The 100, which I think you can probably find all of that on Netflix. Seasons 1 through 3 are so strong. And that was like basically in a nuclear apocalypse wiped out Earth. And so there were pockets of humanity that were sent up into space. There were rules like governing the society, like you could only have one kid because they only had so many resources, and they ended up having to drop 100 people down to Earth. Some of these are like convicts, or a lot of them are basically teenagers. They're just like getting rid of, they're offloading their extra population, which is sad. And then they find out, oh, Earth is kind of okay, and they set up their own little society.
Was that CW show?
It was a CW show, yeah.
Yeah, now I remember that. I never watched it, but I do remember that. Yeah. So there's a lot of stuff in this genre out there that is both frightening.
Yeah.
Like The Road, for instance, is one of the works I always come back to.
Yeah.
But also some stuff that is compelling in that it's either positive or it's somewhere in the middle, and it's compelling enough to, even if it's kind of like your typical like fun to watch sci-fi show or novel that's not like, you know, high-minded literary stuff, it's still fun to have fun reading it, you know, enjoy it.
I guess I'll talk a little bit about the author and the book as well. And I mean, frankly, I've got a biography in the back of my book, so I'm just going to read a bit from that. Yeah, so that cuts out the Wikipedia middleman. So Pat Frank was the lifelong nickname adopted by the American writer, newspaperman, and government consultant who was born Harry Hart Frank, and who is remembered today almost exclusively for his post-apocalyptic novel, Alas, Babylon, published at the height of the Cold War amid fears of nuclear annihilation. Frank's enduring novel remains a classic reminder of what preoccupied millions during the 1950s and 1960s. Harry Hart Frank was born on May 5th, 1908 in Chicago, the son of Harry Hart Frank Sr. and Doris Cohen Frank. After what was, from all available evidence, a typical Midwestern childhood and adolescence, young Harry went on to the University of Florida in Gainesville. His college sojourn lasted only 2 academic years, and in 1927 he started work as a reporter for the Jacksonville Journal, beginning a newspaper career that would last through World War II. After 2 years in Jacksonville, Frank moved on to the now-defunct New York Journal, where he remained through 1932. The following year took him to the nation's capital, where he joined the staff of the Washington Herald and discovered the fascinating, intriguing, and maddening complexities of American politics and government. He was a reporter for 5 years for the Herald, and then became chief of the Washington Bureau of the Overseas News Agency, a position that expanded his awareness and knowledge of government doings and misdoings beyond the District of Columbia and the borders of the United States. His work during his 3-year stint at the agency must have attracted the attention of Franklin Roosevelt's White House and the War Department, for in 1941 he was appointed Assistant Chief of Mission at the Office of War Information. His 3 years there provided him with considerable experience with the exposure to key areas of war preparedness and planning, lessons that he would carry with him through the rest of his life. His performance at the Office of War Information and 3 years as a war correspondent in Italy, Austria, Turkey, Hungary, and Germany, once again in affiliation with the Overseas News Agency, won him a War Department commendation in 1945. With the end of World War II, Frank ended all work as a regular journalist and information handler, whether in the employ of newspaper agency or government bureau. He would write novels, nonfiction books on current affairs, almost exclusively having to do with nuclear technology and weaponry, and numerous stories and articles which appeared over the years in many popular consumer magazines, as well as in limited journals. The book that launched Frank's second career as novelist and independent writer was Mr. Adam, a novel which gave voice to his observations on government and military bureaucracy and their malfunctions, as well as on the threat of nuclear proliferation and annihilation. in Affair of State, published in 1948, continued Frank's lampooning of governmental and political malfunction, misfunction, and dysfunction. And that novel is followed 4 years later by Hold Back the Night, a vivid account of the Korean conflict. Forbidden Area, with a tone more brooding than satirical, deals directly with the possibility of ultimate nuclear conflict and the failure of the U.S. government and bureaucracy to prepare or respond adequately. And, of course, then we have Alas, Babylon, which was published in 1959, and it confirmed that he was serious and knowledgeable about the effects of nuclear warfare and that the public was as concerned as he was. And, of course, we'll talk about that. So, after Alas, Babylon, during the remaining 5 years of his life, Frank concentrated on writing for magazines and journals, putting his beliefs and concerns to political use, and advising various government bodies. In 1960, he served as a member of the Democratic National Committee. In 61, he received an American Heritage Foundation Award, and he was consultant to the National Aeronautics and Space Council. And he did take enough time to write How to Survive the H-Bomb and Why, a straightforward advisory on post-Holocaust living. From 63 through 64, the Department of Defense made use of Frank's expertise and advice, and this consultancy turned out to be his last response to his country's call. He died on October 12, 1964, in Atlantic Beach, Florida, the community that had named him Honorary Chief of Staff of its Navy back in 1949. And I should have done, like, historical. I think I messed up because this was written in 1959. Mm-hmm. And, of course, at this time, there's already heightened fear as to an attack might happen. You of course, know much of this. Would you like to – sorry to be lazy and pass it off.
No.
That was my bad. But you've done it, so I don't need to –
Well, it's interesting because, like, you know, you have through most of the back half of the 40s where we had the bomb. And then in the very late 40s, you have the Soviets finally testing their first atomic bomb, which led to the espionage trial of, you know, Julius and Ethel Rosenberg. Oh. And then the Chinese government, which was overthrown in 1949, and you have the rise of Mao Zedong, gets it as well. But it's the US and the Russians that are basically in this arms race, right, throughout most of the 50s, 60s, and then things start to ease a little bit into the 70s and go back up to the 80s, and then in the early 80s and the late 80s we get, you know, glasnost, perestroika, etc. They were all operating on this principle of mutually assured destruction. The fact that we never went to nuclear war was because it would mean complete devastation. And, you know, did you want to be necessarily responsible for that? And so very often, like, there was that weird tension that would we do it, would we not do it? And I know in the very late 1959 and into 1960, you had a little bit of a thaw, because this is when you had Khrushchev come to America and tour. But that ends when really, like, in the middle of his trip, I believe it was, and I'm doing this off the top of my head, so forgive me if I'm factually incorrect. It's when Gary Francis Powers, gets shot down in his U-2 spy plane over the Soviet Union, and Khrushchev cuts his visit short, and things ramp up, and then, you know, this is 59, 62 is the Cuban Missile Crisis, which is the closest we ever came to nuclear war. And it's a it was a really, like, I mean, obviously neither of us lived through it, but everything I've read or seen, there's a great movie called 13 Days with Kevin Costner and Bruce Greenwood that is about the Kennedy administration during the time. And it is tense. And I can't imagine what it was like to live through that, knowing that you could die. Yeah. And around this time, after this, maybe like 60, 61 or so, you had a couple of movies that really dealt with this. Failsafe is a television movie that took it very, very seriously and kind of showed the sort of tension of leading up to war. And then on the flip side, the satirical side, you have what is one of my favorite movies of all time, Dr. Strangelove, or How I Learned to Stop Worrying and Love the Bomb. And I think that was 60 or 62. Directed by Stanley Kubrick. So there's, I mean, like, I could go on and on and on and recommend, like, Cold War media for people. But yeah, this is around a period where we were building and building and building and building the nuclear arsenal. And we were getting close to what would eventually become intercontinental ballistic missiles, which meant that you didn't need to bomb a country with a like a B-52 or something, you could just launch it from a missile silo somewhere in the middle of like Iowa or something, and it would take 30 minutes or something to hit Moscow. And that was even more terrifying. Mm-hmm. So.
Yep. And Iowa indeed, since that's mentioned here. I wanted to read the preface to this book. It's not very long because it comes from Frank, and it's how this idea germinated and became a book. So I thought that that was good. And then I'll talk about some influences he had, and that'll be basically it for the history portion. So, I have an acquaintance, a retired manufacturer, a practical man, who has recently become worried about international tensions, international missiles, H-bombs, and such. One day, knowing that I had done some writing on military subjects, he asked, quote, "What do you think would happen if the Ruskies hit us when we weren't looking? You know, like Pearl Harbor," end quote. The subject was on my mind. I had recently returned from a magazine assignment at Offutt Field, headquarters of the Strategic Air Command, several SAC operational bases, and the Missile Test Center on Cape Canaveral. More to the point, I had been discussing just such a possibility with several astute British staff officers. The British have lived under the shadow of nuclear-armed rockets longer than we. Also, they have a vivid memory of cities devastated from the skies, as have the Germans and Japanese. A man who has been shaken by a two-ton blockbuster has a frame of reference. He can equate the impact of an H-bomb with his own experience, even though the H-bomb blast is a million times more powerful than the shock he endured. To someone who has never felt a bomb, bomb is only a word. An H-bomb's fireball is something you see on television. It is not something that incinerates you to a cinder in the thousandth part of a second. So the H-bomb is beyond the imagination of all but a few Americans, while the British, Germans, and Japanese can comprehend it, if vaguely. And only the Japanese had personal understanding of atomic heat and radiation. It was a big question. I gave him a horseback opinion, which proved conservative compared with some of the official forecasts published later. I said, quote, "Oh, I think they'd kill 50 or 60 million Americans, but I think we'd win the war," end quote. He thought this over and said, "Wow, 50 or 60 million dead. What a depression that would make." I doubt if he realized the exact nature and extent of the depression, which is why I'm writing this book. And that was in 1959. So for influences on people, this was mentioned on Wikipedia, John Lennon, who was already mm-hmm. a pacifist, was given a copy of Alas, Babylon by journalist Larry King in 65. Apparently, he spent all night reading the book. Basically, it fueled his anti-war fervor and gave him a picture of what it would look like to see the world's population crawling back from the horrors of a nuclear catastrophe. Literature... Let's see. In his critical study, The Modern Weird Tale, in 2001, S.T. Joshi, compares The Last Babylon favorably with Stephen King's The Stand, calling the former a, quote, "more interesting treatment of the same basic theme." The foreword of the 2005 edition, which I have, was written by David Brin. And that he notes that it was instrumental in shaping his own views on nuclear war and influenced his own book, The Postman, which came out in 1982.
I've heard that book's good. The movie is terrible. I've never seen the movie. It's like one of the big Kevin Costner bombs from the 90s.
I didn't know that was an apocalyptic thing. Why did I think that that was like Western?
I think it's Western-esque, but it takes place in the post-apocalypse.
Oh, wow.
I've never seen it, but I just remember it bombing.
In the acknowledgement section at the beginning of his post-apocalyptic novel, One Second After, in 2009, William R. Forstichen credits Alas, Babylon as an influence in writing his novel about the small town of Black Mountain, North Carolina. Is set in a time after numerous electromagnetic pulses strike around the world. Okay, and then John Ringo's 2013 Under a Graveyard Sky, the first in his Black Tide Rising series, starts with an emergency code using the phrase, Alas, Babylon. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And there was an adaptation of Alas, Babylon, broadcast on April 3rd, 1960, as the 131st episode of the Playhouse 90 dramatic television series. And it starred, get this, Don Murray, Burt Reynolds, and Rita Moreno.
Rita Moreno, national treasure, by the way. She has an EGOT.
Oh, yeah.
She does.
Oh, so. Boy. Well, any thoughts?
No, I just, it is interesting to see how influential the book was, and in this part of the genre. So, yeah, let's get to the plot.
Let's do it. Okay. Well, in 1959, tensions have escalated for 2 years between the United States and the Soviet Union for dominance in the Middle East and in the Mediterranean Sea. The Soviets are menacing Turkey from three sides through their proxies in Egypt, Syria, and Iraq in order to gain control of the Bosphorus and give free passage between the Black Sea and the Mediterranean to their large Mediterranean naval fleet. To counteract the Soviet threat, the United States established a military presence in Lebanon and is providing aid to their Turkish and Israeli allies. Meanwhile, the Soviets gained a temporary space supremacy through the launch of a fleet of militarized Sputniks. Moreover, they are... Look at all these transitional words. Moreover, they are aware that within 3 or 4 years, the United States will cover the gap. Intelligence from a Soviet officer who defected in Berlin provided information about a Soviet war plan involving a sudden, overwhelming nuclear first strike on U.S. and NATO military and civilian targets in order to minimize retaliation and to ensure that the Soviet Union becomes the leading world power. According to the leaked war plan, the Soviet leadership considers acceptable the loss of 20 to 30 million of their own civilian population due to an anticipated retaliatory strike by NATO. Randy Bragg, a failed political candidate and an attorney who occasionally practices law, lives an otherwise aimless life in the small central Florida town of Fort Repose. The younger bachelor son of a prominent local family, his ancestors founded Fort Repose in the 1800s. Randy's older brother, Colonel Mark Bragg, a U.S. Air Force intelligence officer at Strategic Air Command, SAC, headquarters at Offutt Air Force Base in Omaha, Nebraska, sends a telegram to Randy ending in the words, "Alas, Babylon." A pre-established code between the brothers to warn of imminent disaster. Shortly thereafter, Mark flies his family down to Orlando in order to stay with Randy at Fort Repose for their protection while Mark remains at SAC headquarters. Soon afterwards, a carrier-based U.S. Navy fighter pilot attempting to intercept a Soviet plane over the Mediterranean inadvertently destroys an ammunition depot at a large Soviet submarine base in Latakia, Syria. The explosion is mistaken for a large-scale U.S. air assault on the military facility, and by the following day, the Soviet Union retaliates with its planned full-scale nuclear strike against the United States and its allies. With Mark as a witness, U.S. intercontinental ballistic missiles are launched at the Soviet Union in retaliation. Randy and his guests awake to the shaking from the nuclear missile attacks on nearby military bases such as McCoy Air Force Base in Orlando and Naval Air Station Sanford. One explosion temporarily blinds Peyton, Randy's niece. The results? The residents of Fort Repose later observe other mushroom clouds to the southwest and northeast, implying that MacDill Air Force Base and the city of Tampa, as well as the city of Jacksonville and its multiple U.S. naval installations, have been destroyed. I'm pretty sure that Josh and Shagger, bye-bye. Following what is simply referred to as the day, Fort Repose descends into chaos. Tourists are trapped in their hotels, communication lines fail, the Conrad radio system barely operates, convicts escape from prisons, and a run on the banks makes currency worthless. In the weeks and months after the attack, sporadic news gathered through an old but still functioning vacuum tube radio receiver show that many major cities of the U.S. are in ruins and vast regions of the continental United States are labeled by the government as off-limits, contaminated zones. Because of the numerous U.S. Air Force and U.S. Navy installations from one end of the state to the other that were struck during the Soviet attack, Florida is among the contaminated areas, leaving the stranded survivors of Fort Repose without hope of immediate assistance. Most of the U.S. government has been eliminated, with the U.S. presidency defaulting to Josephine Van Brueker Brown, the former Secretary of Health, Education, and Welfare, so they really had to lose a lot of people, who is believed to be leading the nation from a location in Colorado. Other international broadcasts heard over the shortwave radio of Randy's neighbor, retired Navy Rear Admiral Sam Hazard, reveal that Western Europe was badly hit by Soviet missiles as well, mentioning a dire situation in southern France. Soviet leadership was eliminated by the U.S. retaliation, and the Soviet capital was moved to Central Asia, but war still rages for months after the attack, although it is fought mostly between the remnants of the U.S. Air Force and scattered Soviet Navy nuclear submarines. A Korean War veteran still serving as a U.S. Army Reserve infantry officer before the Soviet attack, Randy learns in a radio dispatch by President Van Brugger Brown that she has directed any surviving active duty or reserve U.S. military officers to form local militias to keep the peace domestically. This formally empowers Randy as a local authority under the current emergency situation. He then organizes a community self-defense force against bandits and tries to rid the community of radioactive jewelry brought into Fort Repose from the radioactive ruins of Miami. The search for alternative food sources is also prominent in the months following the attack, leading to the launch of a ragtag fleet of fishing boats to sift the surrounding lakes, rivers, and swamps for fish, and to a desperate search for much-needed salt. The following year, an Air Force helicopter arrives at Fort Repose. The crew assesses the status of the residents and the local environment, explaining that the area around Fort Repose is perhaps the largest patch of non-contaminated soil in Florida, and that, after everything they have suffered, the survivors of Fort Repose manage to fare better than many other parts or places in the U.S. Randy also learns that his brother Mark most likely died. Helen was holding on for dear life, even though she fell in love with the doctor. Most likely died when Omaha and Offutt Air Force Base were destroyed by multiple Soviet nuclear missile strikes. When the crew of the helicopter offered to evacuate the residents out of Florida, the residents choose to stay. It is eventually revealed that the United States formally won the war, but at a tremendous cost. The country lost most of its population, 45 million survivors are estimated overall, most of its military, its infrastructure, and most of its natural resources. Ironically, the U.S. government is planning to use the large stockpiles of military-grade uranium and plutonium left from the war to power the surviving towns and cities with nuclear reactors. The U.S. is now receiving food, fuel, and medicine aid from third world countries such as Thailand, Indonesia, and Venezuela. Maybe they'll be second world instead of third world after that. According to a radio broadcast, the three greats, India, China, and Japan, have taken the role of world leading powers in place of U.S. and the Soviet Union. The book ends by saying that things will not return to normal for 1,000 years because of the fallout, and that Randy, quote, turned to face the 1,000-year night, end quote. And I will say that that synopsis, thank you Wikipedia, was kind of an overall of like the state of things and of course how people are managing. But I think when we get into our discussion, we'll talk more specifically about how our who our characters are and specific episodes as well, because I think you could kind of really fall into a hole about talking, this day they did this and this, and Randy got a haircut by Helen, and then Dan, the doctor, he got beat up and he almost lost an eye, and then you saw all of this stuff. So just know we will get in to some of these details, but that was the overall of A Last Babylon. Tom, did you enjoy A Last Comma Babylon?
I did.
Okay.
I do have some criticisms, and we'll get to them as we go through the book, but overall I did enjoy it. I'd say the first third of it is a slow build, and there are a couple of parts that drag a little bit, but I think I read the last half like very quickly, so it does pick up as you get into the aftermath of the war.
So I want to talk about that. This wasn't a question that I wrote down, but something that I thought about when I was reading. So I apologize for not preparing you for this. But that's just good. The format of the novel itself, because we are used to, you know, you mentioned The Road. We could talk about Hunger Games. I guess we see it a little bit with Station 11, but we get a lot of the before, as you were saying, which it is that buildup, a lot of the before the strike. Who are these people and kind of that? I guess in Watchmen, right, the minute is like getting closer to midnight, that sort of thing, or the red. Didn't they have that in the Cold War of like the it's needle, it's the thermometer or something?
It's the doomsday clock.
Yeah, it's getting closer. So you kind of feel that build up, but you are getting to know the people these in this town. Yeah. And then, of course, it strikes, and then you get to see what it is immediately after, and then as time goes on and everything. So what did you think about that format, introducing us and leading up to it, as well as some of these minor characters, some of which reappear and maybe just reappear to disappear again for various reasons, such as the banker? Mm-hmm. Or we could mention Rita, because she kind of pops up a couple times, but
she's the one at the Western Union office, right?
Rita is the one that has the gold, and her brother, they're Hernandez's
ex-girlfriend. I think they were romantically involved at one point.
Yes, correct.
There was also the character, and I can't remember her name, who was like the librarian, and there was the one who was the Western Union office.
Yeah, Florence, so. I think, is the Western Union. Yeah, because the first time you meet her and meet Randy, is she thinks that Randy is peeping Tomming her. Peeping Tomming?
Yeah.
I don't even know how you do that. How do you do that? Is it peeping Tomming? How do you make that into a participle?
I don't know.
Okay. I'm going to have to look that up. That's very weird. But yeah, so what do you think about all of that, I guess, you know, also introducing some of these people that are just there briefly, but kind of set up the role of the town?
I think in some ways it's necessary, especially since you have to have like a huge town. And I mean, it's not a huge, huge town. It's not like we're talking about like it was Tampa, for instance. But you need enough of a cast of characters to believe that, to kind of open it up. Or else the entire novel would have taken place like in their little cul-de-sac, so to speak, right?
Yeah.
It's not a cul-de-sac, but it's very cul-de-sac as the way they describe, like the way they all live kind of near each other. You just kind of think of that. And then we get like a bigger character of the town itself. So they're necessary. Some of them, some of them are really stock characters. Some of them seem to serve a purpose of like, it's almost like they have to pay for their sins or something. It's for instance, like greed and things like that, you know, and they're like being punished in a way that is a side effect of the war. I do like that we get the beginning because, yeah, you're right. There's a lot of post-apocalyptic literature that is just truly post-apocalyptic. You know, you don't get we don't know what created Pen M at this point, right? We've never gotten that in the Hunger Games. We got not that we necessarily need to, but we never got that origin. We just know that there was something that happened and it was catastrophic. And from that became Pan Am. Station 11 does get into it because it's got those flashbacks back and forth between the pandemic and then 25 years or so later. World War Z is a good example of a book that does the whole cycle because he's interviewing people 10 years later, but he starts it when the thing starts to break out in China and the virus builds. So we don't start in medias res. And when you get to the American part and stuff, we are starting a little bit before the Great Panic happens. And then when the Great Panic happens, it like goes, all everything was to crap, right? So we get a little bit of that with World War Z. So I think it is interesting to start because a lot of times, I don't know, maybe it's like the American impatience and short attention span. A lot of times it's like we want to get to the good stuff. But I think you need a little world building for this particular book. And I think I thought it took a little too long. Ultimately, he was able to pace it fairly well.
Yeah, I don't remember this book being as long as it is back when I was a freshman. I imagine we read the whole thing. I don't know that they would have done excerpts with us, but when I bought it, because Tom had to get it from the library, which meant I couldn't get it, so I did get a used copy. It's like, oh, wow, it's like 300 pages. But yeah, I like it because I think it's just as far as the literature we've been reading, not the standard where, like you said, we do kind of dive in. So it's nice to see who these people are. It's nice to build up the relationships between the characters, how they know each other potentially, or if there's any sort of antagonism. I think the bank manager or the president, I guess, Edgar, was, mm-hmm. you know, interesting because he had a relationship and it has an antagonistic one with Randy's, like, relatives, and then that whole money fiasco, and then he is so reliant upon the money he ends up taking his own life. You have Porky, who is the government, he was a politician who ended up beating Randy. So you get to see these people kind of how their life is like, and it might be all cushy before, but a lot of them can't handle the after, and so you kind of see their downfall as well. And I liked seeing a little bit of that, and I feel like he transitions pretty well between the two. I mean, there's certainly a break, but you're like, oh, who is this person? And then you're kind of wondering, how is this going to play into the rest of the narrative? And he does inevitably come back to these people. And having Randy at the center of it is great, because you could kind of, I think, do a diagram having him at the center of the web, and everyone mm-hmm. seems to connect really well with him, which is great. And he has this, it's interesting that the Wikipedia summary said, like, the residents decided not to leave. Not the residents of Fort Repose, it's just the resident of Randy's house.
Yeah, like the little group of people that they're with. So it's maybe like, what, 8 or 9 people at that point, or maybe even a little less than that.
Yeah, because he would often invite, like, Malachi and the preacher over, and then Hazard, and then the McGoverns ended up living over there as well. So it's very much like their own unique little community or family. So I enjoyed that he builds it up, like, oh, who are these people? And some of them are, they each have their own really distinct personality, which I think is great, because Florence just seems like this, I don't know, kind of nervous person, who I guess is kind of like a school marm looking person, or an old maid who does the Western Union. She's very proud of it. And I think she appears to be a gossip, but if it's really important, she won't gossip about it. That's what it says. And then Alice is the librarian, and boy, does she come into play later on. But with Florence, it's her menagerie, I think, is really big, because the goldfish come into play, and her cats and her birds and everything. So I find it very interesting. Let's talk about the title, I guess. It's right there staring us in the face. What are your thoughts on the fact that, you know, Frank is pulling from Revelations in the Bible for this chapter, and that there's that connection in there? Do you feel like it has any connection to the United States of the 50s, or even maybe today?
It didn't surprise me that he used a reference to the Revelation, because it's well known as the book of the Bible that supposedly tells the story of the end of the world, however, you know, you want to interpret it. So that would be a fairly well-known reference of sorts to people. Yeah, and we are talking about a book about what is ostensibly the end of the world. So yeah, I mean, that did make a lot of sense. I don't know what Pat Frank's, how religious he was or not. I know that you have, I mean, throughout United States history, you've had a religious fervor among a certain segment of the population. So there is that appeal to those people. And I would say you can apply the book of Revelation to any place at any time, you know, especially when you are in the decline and downfall of a particular empire, or that particular transitional phase between one age into another. So him choosing this where it would be like the true end of an age, and something that you are bringing hellfire down upon, you know, the world, is a very apt allusion.
Yeah, I've sat in biblical studies, and maybe I know if any sermons necessarily, because I'm trying to think if I would ever think of my preacher making this leap, but
yeah,
definitely, like,
neither.
people saying that the U.S. is very much Babylon, just like Rome was.
Yeah,
so
I've heard
inevitably
that.
There's going to be this, like, fiery downfall, and I think it's going to keep getting worse, because a lot of people see this current age as, like, there's a major decline in morality. So I feel like it probably, to many, the Last Babylon would definitely fit that. As for the 1950s, I would say that maybe their value, the way that they lived is, like, I would say completely different. I think their values were a bit more strict. Mm-hmm. I mean, if people looked back now, they'd be like, oh, look at their morality. So maybe less, but I think there's always something happening.
It's a very patriarchal book in a few ways, as far as the morality or values are concerned. And of course, claiming the morality of this country now is declining. It depends on who you're talking to. And sometimes those who are crowing about the decline of morality because of what they see are blind to the immorality of those they think are their savior. Hmm. Without getting too specific.
Oh, sure, yeah.
But no, this is that was one of the big criticisms I have, and I was trying very hard to put myself to remember when it was written, but it's very patriarchal.
Well, I guess I'd like you to explain that, because when I think of that, I definitely think, like, women are in a certain position, which I definitely get. But then Frank is pretty subtle about it, but he doesn't shy away from the fact that, well, Randy's sexually active. Randy mm-hmm. and Rita got together. Randy and Lib, as much as they're able, get together. Though I don't really understand why she didn't just share his bed initially, why Lib had to stay with Helen. That would have alleviated many pressures, I think, initially. So there's, like, some, I think, sexual freedom in this book. But do you more mean, like, the relationship between men and women?
Yeah, I'm talking about the dynamics among the sexes in the book, not the sex in the book. The men are the protectors. The men are doing the labor. The boy, Mark's son, has to be the man of the house now. The girls are doing the laundry. They are doing the cooking. It is very, very that particular society, and the one who and there are consequences for those who do not follow the values that he is attaching to the good people in the story,
which I would say was symbolized by Peyton. But mm-hmm. do you think that might be Frank maybe seen or saying that the next generation will usher in a change? So Peyton, just to give an idea, little girl, when it first strikes and she is blinded, later on she comes up with the idea about the armadillos, but mm-hmm. she's not allowed to participate, and then she doesn't get any credit. And then later on, still, when they are losing fish is not around because it's really hot in the summer. She has an idea. Well, she figures out where they're going to be because she asks the preacher. And then she steals Florence's goldfish as bait, and she's able to get some big bass. Mm-hmm. And she is spanked for that. So there's your immediate consequence.
Yeah.
And she, like, wants to be a hero. She's you know, looking at these men and be like, why can't I be like that? She ends up receiving the title of hero, or at least feeling that way, because she finds records and a shaving kit and things in the attic, which seems really inane and I guess goes to your point. But do you think that the fact that she is kind of chafing against her role and is trying to do more, and I mean, for lack of a better phrase, be like the guys, but just, like, be in a position of provision. Could Frank be saying anything about that? The coming generation has more freedom? Or do you think it's just cause and effect, the spanking, because she stepped out of line?
Maybe a little bit of both. I mean, he might be pointing out the resourcefulness that you just need in that way, because her mother was also resourceful just in the way of keeping house. I was actually thinking of Rita.
Oh.
Who is very assured when he meets with her. You could tell that can see the independence in her. But she's kind of I don't know if the Whore of Babylon is the right allusion here, but there's something about her, because she ends up getting sick and dying from the irradiated gold, that this is, oh, the sins that you're doing are coming back to get you. It feels very, very like that.
I'm going to fact you know, check you and tell you that she didn't die. Her brother did.
Her brother did.
Yeah.
But her brother did get the, you know, yeah. So, but her brother, you know, so she still had to suffer though, because of the fact that they were hoarding this gold and all these things. And,
yeah.
And so it's, and she is seen as not a good character. You know, it's kind of left. I don't remember what her fate is in the book, to be honest with you. But yeah, I just see her as the sort of like she's the sort of the foil in the relationship with Randy, because Randy's the woman who eventually becomes his wife is not saintly per se, but there's definitely a purity there. That's where the sex does come in as far as the values are concerned.
Yeah. The Hernandez siblings are really interesting, because if you look at them compared to the community that Randy has,
mm-hmm.
they're stockpiling, the Hernandez family is stockpiling useless things,
mm-hmm.
televisions, like really expensive stuff,
material goods,
absolutely, because they think that there's going to be like a second kind of wave of like, well, when this is all over, people are going to need this stuff and then we're going to be rich. And because and where they live in Pistolville, which seemed like it was the other side of the tracks, and then it really becomes
great,
like uncivilized afterwards. It seems like they did not have a lot, and Randy actually preys on it, which is probably like the lowest character moment, in my opinion, for him, because he offers a lot of cash for, I don't know if it was gas or if it was coffee. It was some good. And
I think it was coffee.
It might have been, yeah. And he knew.
Because he kept trying to get coffee from people.
He knew that the money had no use, but Rita's brother was like super excited about having all of that money. So I could potentially see that. Yeah, the quote unquote Whore of Babylon. But she ends up being useful. He does kind of cut ties with her when Randy and the doc visit. Her brother's very much on the way out. They learn the story of where that gold came from, which is very much symbolic, I think, of greed anyways.
Mm-hmm.
And then she has a ring, and so she has a mark on her finger, but she was able to get it off in time. But later on, when they are tracking down the people, the brigands who seriously injured the doc and then killed the beekeeper and his family, he uses a grocery truck that she ended up having, as well as gas that she had. So she was able to come through with them. But I think that was kind of their last connection, or the last time.
Yeah, because I think that's toward the climax of the book, too.
Yes.
If I remember correctly. So she gets redeemed a little bit by helping him. Do you
think there's anything in like the frivolity of women? Is there like a commentary on that, you think?
I was wondering if that's a little bit of what he's getting there with her too. That, you know, yeah. I mean, I'm glad that he had part of this town be chaotic and Wild West, sort of, you know, people, every man for themselves, people like literally killing each other for what they could, the scraps that they could get. Because had you had this entire novel just take place in this little alcove that they have, or cove that they have, it would have actually been boring. And you would have needed a reason for it to all come crashing down. Like you would have had to event like a natural disaster or something else to shake things up, because it would have just been them, you know, them figuring out how to live would have been interesting only so long. So the fact that he gets deputized basically,
yeah,
and is able to go out, that brings a little more tension back into the novel, because you get to go out among the world. And because he introduced these people at the beginning of the novel, or he introduced the kind of outlying area at the beginning of the novel, when he goes back out to the outlying area, we've been there already. So it's not like, oh, all of a sudden he's out in the town. So there's that connection there. And we get to see that not everything is as nice there as it is here. And it feels realistic in that way, and it feels lived in.
Absolutely. And the fact that not everyone is going to deal with this in the same way.
No.
And so if some people are going to become resourceful, maybe because of their poverty, like the Hernandezes, and others, I think, will just kind of maybe give up and just live in this wild way.
Yeah. Well, and also, I don't – this is going to come off of – this is going to come off sounding cold. I liked the fact that there were at least one character, maybe a couple more, who did die by suicide. Ooh. In the book, as a result of the events, because again, that's realistic too. There are people who would do that because it's just too overwhelming. And they would take themselves, some of them would take themselves and their families with them out of a depression or a desperation, an unwillingness to, you know, there's just, there's something to be said about that too. And I'm glad he didn't shy away from that.
Yeah, it was sad because Edgar, I think his worth just seemed to be wrapped up in the bank and in money.
Yeah.
And so without it, because he knew exactly what was going to happen without it, he felt like there was no reason for him to be around.
There's a trope of stories like this where the rich guy gets what's coming to them in some sort of way, whether it be something like this or the very typical, I'm the rich, arrogant jackass, let me on the lifeboat, and the people on the lifeboat are like, you've got to wait your turn like everybody else, money means nothing here. And I think so I'm glad we had that, because not every survivor of a millionaire survivor of a disaster is Thurston Howell III. So
I will say, though, the character that befuddled me because of his behavior was Bubba Offenhaus, who was the owner of the local funeral parlor, and because he was refusing to, like, bury people and just wasn't helpful, and it had to be done at gunpoint to bury some of these people that had the and put the gold in the ground and everything too.
Yeah,
I just didn't know why he was. And yes, he did do some burials, but I guess he was like getting tired of it. But I'm just like, but if it's your job, what's going on here? Why are you backing down from this?
Maybe he was tired of it or something, because burying them in a formal way actually makes sense with the radiated gold, especially because he's putting them in like a casket.
Right.
And that would protect, conceivably, lessen the chance of the ground getting and perhaps the water supply getting more radiated. Maybe he's just – that's his giving up, that he's – he is tired and refusing the funeral is the only thing he has. I don't know. I was kind of a little bit befuddled by that too. There are so many people dead though. It's like, what do you do with that many? Cause you have, especially since it's like, it is irradiated soil in some cases, or even where he is, it's like, you know, do you do like what you would have done in World War I, where a lot of these battlefields are just, people are just buried there.
Yeah,
because it's thousands upon thousands of people. So when you go to a battlefield, World War I battlefield, it's just rows and rows of crosses, right? Do you do that? Do you set them all on fire? Or do you risk the pollution from that? You know, so it is. That is an issue that kind of gets talked about here, but not to the extent that that we really have an answer to. Like, what do you do with all of the people who are? Who don't get obliterated by the bomb but die slowly afterward.
Yeah. I don't know if Bubba's reasonings were also connected to money, because he was making a big deal about that final coffin, how much he paid for it and how much he sells it for. And so maybe he, like, only doing his job is only connected to what he can get out of it. I don't know.
Also, I don't know if it's like a, but if you think of it another way, it's this thing that's like a symbol of the former way of things. So like, there's a sadness in saying this is what this is and this is how much I paid for it, because it doesn't really matter at this point. But it's that he's sad about that because that's the way things used to be, and he misses that in some sort of way. Like, it's just it's a pain. It's pain from the loss of the previous world.
Yeah.
And he's expressing it in that way because it's the only thing he's got left to hold on to, or something like that. And I think that gives me a little bit of a sympathy for the character in that moment.
Yeah, good point. Well, during the section with Edgar, after the bombs have gone off, it's remarked that the people who lived through and remember the rationing in 1942 and 1943 will be more equipped for this present time after these bombs. And I was just wondering, Tom, do you feel like we in 2024 are equipped for such an event?
There are people who certainly keep buying things because they think they're going to be equipped. There's a whole doomsday prepper subculture in our world. I don't think. Look, we couldn't handle sitting in our houses during the pandemic. We flipped out and bought toilet paper when we didn't need to buy toilet paper. I watched a good portion of this country 4 years ago help each other out as best they could, lose a lot of people, mourn, and then I saw a good portion of this country get completely unhinged and believe lies and believe and this cult-like behavior. So it will be chaos if this ever happens or something like this happens. And a lot of people are not prepared. You are going to get the looters and you're going to get the people who run into the stores and those who think now it's a good time for an every man for themselves and will go around killing. And then you'll have the people who will pull together in the face of a disaster. So it's a mixed bag, but I think as a society collectively, we're probably not ready because we're also very comfortable in the way we live. And we're also very comfortable that our government's still going to be here and like all these things. So once those comforts go away, some people will adjust. Some people will have a hard time adjusting, but eventually get it. Others will.
Yeah. I do think about our younger generations, you know, the ones we're teaching and just like, man, are you going to be okay with that? Like technology, are you going to be able to help out, you know, and not be kind of griping or freaking out? Cause that would just be, if they're willing, there's like such a boon to just being willing to learn or help. And I'm afraid that maybe this generation will be more like, I don't know, just like kind of give up and just sit there and not do anything.
I tend to agree with you. I think there are those in this generation but will also be very helpful to one another because they have communities around them. And I think that's where you would see the value of those who are in marginalized communities and form their own like found families and things that I think they're going to be better off.
Yeah.
Because they have a very organic unit as opposed to those who follow demagogues.
Do you think it would be beneficial for everyone to take a survival course once in their life?
I think there's like a disaster preparedness course that you could certainly do. I mean, when we were kids, I remember doing something where we learned like how to like plan a fire escape route from your house. We did CPR stuff in health class. You know, I grew up on Long Island where you would get some wicked storms and stuff like that. So we knew about hurricane preparedness. And there's other things like the basic things like knowing how long food is good for and taking some basic or learning the basics of like some life skills that don't wholly rely on technology all the time. You know, can you start a campfire?
Yeah.
You know, can you cook? You know,
yep.
I can cook. When I was 14, I could probably make oatmeal. But but like, you know, you think about people these days, like who cooks, who cleans, who a lot of us domestically are not as up on these things. There's going to be a lot of men who can't handle themselves. And that could go really bad, or it could be for them, or it could be bad for us because they have been babied their whole lives and they've never had to learn how to do these things. Yeah.
Good luck to us all.
Shag will protect us.
Oh, Shag! Heck yeah, the shag was blown away because it's basically all Florida.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. He's sitting on a beach looking at his feet in a book and just...
My gosh, what a wonderful vision for him. Race relations in this novel. We are late 50s. Racism, well, it's still around now, so it's definitely around there. There's definitely some racism in the town pre-bomb. Randy is friends with the Henrys, and some people don't really appreciate that. I think the banker does not like that. But on page 90, we find out kind of how things have changed. A third of the traders in Marines Park on this day were Negroes. The economics of disaster placed a penalty upon prejudice. The laws of hunger and survival could not be evaded and honored no color line. A backyard hen raised by a Negro tasted just as good as the game cocks of Carlton Hawes, the well-to-do realtor who was a vice president of the county White Citizens Council, and there was more meat on it. So just an example, obviously Randy did not change character-wise because he was always friends with the Henrys. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, do you feel like this novel suggests any way of resolving race issues?
I think it's realistic in thinking that, like, a lot of people will put aside race issues or no. I don't know how many people it would change. Really change are the people who would have not had a problem with race, who were supportive of, you know, Black, Hispanic, whomever people. But now that we are in a disaster, they're more brave on speaking up and supporting, whereas in the past they might have been scared to because of the bullying presence of the racists in their town, many of whom were probably police officers. And so when you see that things are a lot different now, maybe your resolve strengthens. And I think that might have been part of it, because there's certainly still people in the area who still hold those values and would still act racist towards the towards that family. Because racism in Florida, never heard of that.
I would hope that, my gosh, in the face of this sort of disaster, that people would realize that there is like a priority list,
mm-hmm.
and that there's really no reason for that to be anywhere on the priority list.
I do too. And I think there are a lot of people who will feel vindicated, justified, or whatever, and be like, you're right, that race, this is just not something that we need. And then there are people who will double down on their prejudice.
Yeah.
It's just, I think that's the moralistic kind of gray area view of it.
Yeah, and probably go back, like, way back times and just mm-hmm. steal things from those people and say yeah. that it was theirs rather than trading.
Yeah. By the way, it does bother me that the Black guy dies in this novel.
That he's the only one of the crew that dies.
He's one of the few people in that crew who died. Like, you know, why when they go on this mission... He is the only one who dies, like get killed by the bandits or whatever they are, brigands. And because they get caught in that, you know, at one point they do get caught in that very typical trap of like the girl on the side of the road, and then they go after and everything. But in the whole confrontation at the end, which is very well written, it did bug me that the Black guy is the one who dies.
But he was so heroic because he said, I'm going to drive. And then he leapt out at the man with the baseball bat.
Yeah, I would know. Yeah, he at least he dies a heroic death, but I'm just like, couldn't you have killed one of the white people?
Oh gosh, yeah.
Because it's such a bad, I mean, we all know the horror movie trope joke is like the Black guy dies first, right? So yeah.
Yeah. And it was interesting that it was Malachi and not Two-Tone, because mm-hmm. Two-Tone was kind of the layabout.
Yeah.
And consistently drunk. But mm-hmm. it was Malachi who was always a hard worker.
Yeah.
And they even, like, at least he's not forgotten because he's, like, brought up again when they're doing some hard work and, like, we miss Malachi. I'm like, I know, I miss Malachi too. Okay, let's see here. What would you say is the sequence of the escalating breakdown of, as we would consider, normal order institutions and mm-hmm. public services? And then how do people react to the sudden absence of services and procedures that they and even we take for granted? And then if you want to pull it to transfer it, because that's a pedagogical thing, how would reactions today be different or similar? And what might you think is the most serious loss?
It seems like there's some panic in the book, but there's some hoarding, but there's also some people with enough patience to figure out like what they need to do in order to kind of establish something that is going to be in the long run, or find out information and things like that. The power, like electrical power and those sorts of things, obviously go first, right? Because of the bomb and everything. But the lines of communication, the being cut off from the world, I think that's the first thing to happen. And the fact that Randy and the people around him do work hard to find out what's going on is a good decision on his part, but is like, you know, is something that I think people would try to do. And we see in other movies and TV shows and novels like this, like somebody's trying to get information from the outside world, because like when you are cut off like this, you don't know what's going on. You don't know what caused it. So, because at one point they're listening to the radio and they're like, it's just a repeating message. And then somebody would break on and give new information. That's how, and it also gives us, the reader, a clue into what's been going on too. So it helps with the plot. But then, you know, like you have, like you were talking about, like the banks and the schools and the libraries and things. And some of them just shut them down. Some of them loot them. Some of them find them more useful than others. I think we'd have similar reactions in some regard. Today, it's like I try to think of what would happen to the institutions that we have. You know, schools would go away. I think in a disaster this size, the monetary system would be useless. But I think that a couple of things would go out immediately, and a few things would take a little while for them to start to be useless. I think money, cash, would kind of be valuable at first, and then that would eventually fade away, because it was just because of, we don't know why, you know, who's going to charge for what you're not getting. You know, like the money is useless at that point, right? You can't get it from anywhere else. So, but I think we'll hold on to that a little bit longer than some other things.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely the material, as long as we are, well, I think it does certainly come in waves, because I think with the initial attack, people think that they should get out their goods with the paper money.
Uh-huh.
And then they realize, I think, depending on the degree of the attack, that that is not going to be helpful. And so once the looting comes in, and hopefully people are getting the supplies that they need, that's also the trading, and the money is what you have. Yeah, absolutely. I think you shut down all non-necessities because people are not concerned, about education. And then once there's... you're kind of in the new normal, quote unquote, then you can kind of bring some stuff back, which I love the fact that the library, which Alice, in her little section, she was unable to get much funding and couldn't get new books. And then all of a sudden, like, everyone is in there all the time. And that kind of also becomes a school, and people are just really loving that. And I think that's both human nature, craving entertainment and kind of an escape from the current life, and also that we are trying to maybe grasp something that can push us forward. And yeah, they were lucky, Fort Repose was lucky that they had electricity for a little bit. It didn't immediately go off. The clean water is a big issue.
Yes.
Yeah, depending on if they had kind of a nice spring, so they were able to do it, but other people had to boil before they could do anything. So it's always very much a danger in all of that. So yeah, I guess immediately systems are kind of down, and then just lawlessness breaks out, and then you start to create your own little, like, it starts to come back in waves as well. I don't know that money would ever come back, though. It was interesting when the helicopter was papering the town with pamphlets, that it equated those to money, because it was basically toilet paper.
Yeah. That's interesting. Some of the other things I was thinking of, like, he didn't get as dark as I think current day entertainment of this variety would with some of the worst behaviors of the survivors.
Yeah.
Because I could see some assaults going on, like sexual assaults going on as well. I would not want to see that in a book. You know my position on that, but of course. I could see it as something that would happen. Yeah, in the breakdown of order. But the water is really important, like those natural resources too, because this is a nuclear war. If it was something different, that like a disease or something like that, where you could still have potable water and things like that, it'd be a little bit different. So I think those circumstances of this utter devastation is what drives a lot of it too. And once you start, and once those things start breaking down, it's getting worse and worse, and things are going to break down even more. Like as you get toward the end of the book, they are running out of things, mm-hmm. and they are running out of water. Like his little cove of people does skirt the disaster of being left in desperation. And you wonder whether or not they're going to turn on each other at any point, or if there will be a suicide or anything like that, yeah. As the situation becomes more and more dire.
Yeah, I mean, especially I think the biggest tension was certainly between Lib and Helen, and it was. She's kind of projecting her feelings for Mark onto Randy.
Yes.
Part of the time, and then the other time wanting to be or considering herself kind of this maternal person and wanting to take care of everything under her. And that just happened to be that crew. So I think there's some territorial behavior as well. So that was like this. But yeah. They seem to become friends-ish. I think it certainly got better, but yeah. So luckily no one, it could have been bad. I was worried about Bill McGovern. Mm. I didn't know that he was going to make it. I couldn't remember after his wife died and he felt like he was useless. I'm like, oh gosh, this man, he's not long for this world.
Mm. The scene where Helen, she's like giving him a haircut.
Yes.
And she starts calling him Mark.
Yep.
Or like it's basically like because he's his brother, he's Mark's brother, and they look a lot alike. It's just she has like a break in that moment. It's really sad.
Oh yeah.
And it's the level of this person's loss that she has probably not fully confronted because she's been so busy being the caretaker. The moment itself is a little clunky in the way it's written. Because it's a little soap opera, like, you know, Mark, it's just a little too dramatic. But I set that aside for the fact that it is so sad. And it is realistic in that way, though, like that something would trigger you and you would have that moment where you're finally like the grief overcomes you because you haven't been able to grieve. I think people do that now when they lose loved ones. Mm-hmm. But they are not given the opportunity to grieve for themselves because they're taking care of everybody else around them.
Yeah.
And I think that's what Helen is doing. So I thought that was a very, really well done aspect of the book.
But then my girl Lib comes in and says, don't worry, I've got a matchmaking idea. Which it takes a long time. But yeah, Dan and Helen do fall in love. But Helen can't emotionally 100% connect to Dan until she thinks about Mark. Okay, Tom, I found it. So what are the consequences for Randy, his family and friends, and all of Fort Repose with his decision to play by the old rules? And in what ways do Randy and others act in accordance with or in opposition to the old rules? And I will read to you what this is about. So he drives by an accident in chapter 5.
Mm-hmm.
This, it says this because he keeps driving. In this second, Randy made an important decision. Yesterday, he would have stopped instantly because he sees someone on the side of the road. There would have been no question about it. When there was an accident and someone was hurt, a man stopped. But yesterday was a past period in history with laws and rules archaic as ancient Rome's. Today, the rules had changed, just as Roman law gave way to atavistic barbarianism as the empire fell to Hun and Goth. Today, a man saved himself and his family, and to hell with everyone else. And at the very end of that paragraph says, with the use of the hydrogen bomb, the Christian era was dead, and with it must die the tradition of the Good Samaritan. So consequences of his decision to act in this way, and do you feel like the characters continued to act in this way? And if they didn't, was there a consequence to that?
This kind of foreshadows, because don't they get jumped by somebody toward the end? Like, don't they?
Dan does. The doc.
Yeah, it's the very typical con of the wounded woman on the side of the road, and then that she's the setup.
Yep.
So it kind of that foreshadows Dan's bad decision later on, where it ends up being a bad decision. I think in that moment, you know, you hate to say it, there's a practicality to the way he's thinking.
Mm-hmm.
I don't mean, oh, he's really smart for doing that, because it might not be a con or an attack, and you have to make a decision of how much trust you're going to put in, you know,
right,
the people. But practically speaking, when you've evaluated the world around you at that moment, not letting this person you know, just passing by this person makes a lot of sense, and it probably does save him. And it shows, like, it's just another kind of layer of, like, pragmatism on his part. Although, you know, the idea of the good Samaritan, but the idea of the community, the old ways of community building are still there too, though. So not all of the old ways are gone, right? Like, they still help one another. There's still the family unit, the extended family unit, loving thy neighbor, mm-hmm. those values, loving your neighbor, et cetera. Those values are there. I think the comment about the Christianity falling is an apt one, because the one thing I actually didn't, you know, correct me if I'm wrong, I don't think we got the religious cult angle in this.
No.
There's a great book. It's like The World We Live In or something. It's a post-apocalyptic thing, because what happens is that the moon gets hit by an asteroid. It gets shoved out of orbit, and there's just natural disasters all over Earth. And it's told through the diary of a teenage girl. And her friend, who is, like, very religious, essentially starts to starve herself to death because she's so devoted to this pastor who has become basically like a, you know, like the reverend in Station 11, and, like, they discover, like, he's been hoarding food and stuff. So, like, the demagogue, the religious demagogue is not in this book. I think that's one thing that would happen in an event like this.
Yeah, there wasn't, besides Preacher, there wasn't really much connection between Randy and religion. So I wonder if that would have been, like, kind of shoehorning something in that Frank had not developed.
Yeah.
I think you're getting to what I would also say, and that you are going to abide by the law of the Good Samaritan mm-hmm. with the people that you trust and you know.
Yes.
Any unknown members that you are coming upon, you might not want to. Now, unfortunately, the doc has his whole Hippocratic Oath.
Yeah.
So for him to drive by someone who is injured would probably be worse for him. So I don't know how that is for, like, you know, people of those professions to actually drop
No good deed goes unpunished.
Yeah, unfortunately. But then we see, you know, other people who aren't intimately connected with Randy and his cohort offering something. And, like, the man who gave a couple honey squares to, and Randy is like very emotional at this. He's like, you know, what can I give you? He's like, no, you know, no child should be without honey. But unfortunately, yeah, he is killed later on. So some people will be taken advantage of, and you might have to. I mean, you said it might be cold, but yeah, you might have to take care of yourself and watch out and not trust. Because people start to act differently in these sorts of situations.
Yeah, or they reveal who they truly are.
Yeah, true.
The thing that bothers me is not that somebody would take advantage of somebody else, because I think you expect that to some certain extent, even in our more civilized society, right? The idea that somebody would be absolutely would take somebody's kindness and turn it into an immoral or violent act, right? Because we've seen that happen before. Mm-hmm. It's the people, always bothers me are the people who look down upon those who simply do give and don't expect anything in return. Like the, I'm going to give you money. Oh, no, don't worry about it. And there's always that other person who's like, what are you doing? You're stupid. Why didn't you ask for money or whatever? When your motivation is just, I just wanted them to have it, right? And I think those people are, I think they're dangerous in a society like this one. Not ours. I mean, I don't like them anyway, but they're a society like the one in the book, like, because they're the ones who try to be the opportunists. Mm. It's a cynical thing, you know, and it does bother you that like some of the Good Samaritan people and some of the people who are doing good things do get hurt.
Yeah.
It's probably realistic, but it still hurts. Yeah. No pun intended.
Well, also in chapter 5, Frank writes of bank president Edgar Quisenberry that, quote, he had forgotten the implacable law of scarcity, end quote. How would you define or describe that law, Tom? And how does it come into play for the people of Fort Repose, and what effects does it have?
Is it like the scarcity of something makes something more valuable? That's like a supply and demand type of thing?
Yeah.
And so the things that are scarce become valuable, and money is more plentiful than or unnecessary, like, or the necessary things when they're scarce, because money is so with him, he really thought that he was going to have some sort of power because he held all the money, you know, as the bank, again, financially, because that's the power in society. It's the power in society that we have now, and it's not necessary in a post-apocalyptic world.
I did find online that if what we desire appears to be in limited supply, the perception of its value increases significantly.
Yeah. So the things that are really – I think when they start to go to like the gazebo in the park – we see it in full play, like they're all trying to barter for coffee or certain vegetables or certain other food or meat or whatever. And there's a pretty civil system that gets set up, and I think Randy enforces those rules pretty well. But like, you know, Edgar is interesting, because Edgar does. He's the one who kills himself. Yep. He could have been helpful in that regard, right? Being the banker, being the accountant of it all, he could have had an important role, but he chose to have this myopic view that the money was going to be the thing without thinking that nobody's going to care about money. They're not going to need money. They're going to need what they need to survive. And in that world, you don't need money to survive. You need, you know, your necessities.
Well, I was already concerned about him anyways, because the teller was giving suggestions and he was not listening. And he's like, who's the president in this situation?
Yeah, he's pride, right?
Yeah.
We have greed. We have pride. I don't know. I think we have lust. Do we have any of the other four sins in this novel where we see consequences?
Potentially, so, yeah.
Yeah.
Through all of them, yeah. Gluttony could also be porky.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So he definitely is there. Something that bugs me about Randy in the book is, I know he's kind of listless at the beginning. you know, he's kind of the brother that wasn't, he's the, you know, in terms of the way he lived his life, he was kind of the opposite of his brother. His brother was a family man, military man, like everything had together. Randy was kind of Randy was essentially the screw up of the two.
Yeah.
He's a bachelor. He's the screw up. You know, he's the other brother.
I wouldn't call him a scrub.
A screw up.
Oh, a screw up. Really?
In a sense. Yeah. Well, I mean, he's like, there are things that he has failed at and he's fallen back on the fact that he has, you know, the money, but people like him. But he's the lesser of the two. He's not the one who made something of himself or whatever as much as his brother did. And he kind of just – so the arc is that he becomes more responsible. He becomes the leader. And maybe I'm misremembering. I don't feel that he is flawed enough as we get further and further on in the novel. I feel that he is too much the upstanding male hero character that we're used to seeing in entertainment of this era. Not exactly the John Wayne type, but kind of skirting that line, because he always seems to be able to rise to the challenge and rise to the occasion. And whereas that works, it makes it compelling. I think it makes him a little, it pushes a little toward a two-dimensional character as opposed to a three-dimensional character.
I'm sorry you feel that way, Tom. I like Randy.
I didn't say I didn't like him. I just thought that some of the way he was written did tend to get a little two-dimensional for the type of character he was.
I guess he's like a Rick Grimes. Mm-hmm. Well, you could say maybe his slight sexism or the fact that he leans in the patriarchy could be his fault. Mm.
If Frank had those views, though, yeah. You know.
But, I mean, he likes the black people.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's definitely that's a plus on his side. I mean, there are upstanding things about him. Huh. I just think he's too much the hero that he needs a little more of something to make him. He almost gets put on a pedestal as the type of character he is.
Do you think this of Atticus Finch?
No, Atticus Finch.
Tom, don't be a hypocrite.
To a certain extent, he is. Oh. Especially when you're looking at through the eyes of Scout, there are some flaws in the character. Now, it has been a while since I read the book. All right, so if we ever do get to Kill a Mockingbird, I always felt there's a little more nuance than people give Atticus Finch credit for when they accuse the book of being a white savior novel. And that's a whole other discussion we can have. But I think that he does get – there is a little bit of the sort of that too, though, because there's a lot of moralizing that comes from the character of Atticus Finch towards Scout, who, because he's always teaching her, mm-hmm. and such. And he is the upstanding man of the community. And I think that he does heroic things in the book that are – objectively heroic. I think Randy does some heroic things in the book as well. But, you know, you can definitely see that, you know, maybe there does need to be more flaws in either of them too. Or maybe if the I'd never read Lee's other book. I really didn't want to read it. But maybe if that particular book didn't have the point of view of a woman looking at her father from it's such a weird thing. She's telling this in flashback, yet she's trying to get back into her head as a little kid. And therefore, who idolized her father. So it's a very odd, it's hard to explain without getting really deep onto Kill a Mockingbird. I will say,
yes,
as good as Gregory Peck is in the movie version, uh-huh. The movie version of Atticus Finch is a very two-dimensional Sandberg figure. Because I think the movie strips things down because it needs to fit it in there. And it's a wonderful movie. But the book is so much richer and has a lot more nuance to it. And when you want to talk about like the savior character and a more two-dimensional character, as good as Peck is so good. But it is a more two-dimensional character.
Would you like to hear something disturbing?
You don't like that book.
No, I overheard some students saying that they believe Atticus Finch is a daddy. So Pedro Pascal type of daddy, not a literal father. So I just want you to sit and think about that.
Have you seen the SNL clip of him where he's playing like the old grandma?
No.
Oh, it's great. So it was around Christmas and he's dressed up as like an old lady and he walks over to a can of Danish butter cookies and rips it open and dumps the cookies in the trash. He takes
Oh, yes. Okay. I'll have to look for that.
Anyway.
Okay, well, we'll move on from that. That'll be some other episode of racism. Okay, well, Helen's in... there's racism in that novel.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Is Helen's inventory of necessities, as she calls them, in Chapter 6 realistic and appropriate? And what would you include in your inventory of necessities in the case of a similar catastrophe and why? Let me turn to this, reader. Yes. Page 125. I found this one. Let's see here. Across the circular wax teak table, looking fresh and competent, Helen sipped a scotch and checked what she called her must list. One of us, she was saying, has got to make another trip to town. I have to have detergent for the dishwasher and washing machine, soap powder, paper napkins, toilet paper. We ought to have more candles, and I wish I could get my hands on some more old-fashioned kerosene lamps. And Randy, what about ammunition?
But the power was on, I think, at this point.
Yeah.
If the power is on, the first half of that list makes sense, right? The dishwasher detergent and the stuff for the washing machine. Napkins and toilet paper... Yeah, the stuff in the back half of the list, definitely, right? The candles, the kerosene lamps, the ammo, you know, if you've got the firearms. So yeah. There's things in there that make sense. There's things in there that later in the novel are rendered useless. But at that point, it seems like a necessity. Mm-hmm. You know, you want – because you're trying to and she's trying to maintain a semblance of normality so you'd have clean clothes as best as you can, right? You know. And I'm sure that once the power went out, they did find a way to clean their clothes and stuff. So, yeah, I mean, I think it's not unrealistic. And I think she's very, very smart. She also is very smart of how she ends up storing food and things like that. She's very resourceful. I think that as a writer, Frank and as a character, Randy both give her credit for what she does because she's, you know, one of the people who does kind of keep them all together and sane and afloat. What would be included in my interest? Oh, God. Candles, matches, lamps, those the sources of light and heat, right? That would be one thing. Batteries. If you could, because I don't know what batteries were back in 1959, but nowadays we have AA batteries and things like that. And if you have a
radio,
then getting batteries for that would be very helpful. Lowe's actually sells like hand crank radios.
Oh,
you can get hand on some of that. Like, see, like that might be a wish list sort of thing. Anything that you could use for long term storage of perishable things as possible. Yeah. Because I would imagine that by that point, non perishable goods, canned food, and things like that are probably getting more and more scarce because that's the first thing to go. I think her list is a good one. What about you?
I would just add some medicinal products.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
She doesn't talk about that at all. I don't think that you can just rely on Doc to be getting everything.
Maybe she was taking that for granted a little bit. Yeah.
Yeah. So, alcohol wipes that, mm-hmm. Well, I mean, like that rubbing alcohol kind of thing.
Yeah.
And maybe some aspirin. Luckily, they don't have any issues because the mother who had diabetes. That's the other. Basically everyone, the majority of people who died were people who had like a cardiac event.
Yeah.
Or had some sort of sickness that needed medicine and that was getting shut down. So like diabetes and.
It's not out of the realm of. Reality that would happen though.
The disease
would definitely perish earlier.
And then you have the resurfacing of old time diseases, which happens. Mm-hmm. It wasn't scarlet fever. What was it that
typhoid?
Oh, was it typhoid? It might have been typhoid.
Typhoid's one of those things that would come back because it usually comes in the water supply.
Yeah.
Right? And
oh, yeah, because they were swimming.
Yeah.
That was the whole thing, yeah.
Yeah, that is one of those things.
Medicinal, yeah, medicinal things.
Well, Florida's really humid, so there are certain things that come with humid climates, that levels of dehydration.
Mosquitoes.
Yeah, malaria.
Malaria, golly, yeah.
So living in the desert would be a whole different thing.
Yeah. Do you think people stole a bunch of prophylactics when they ran in? And
I would imagine that there were a few.
I did wonder how Lib and Randy were preventing pregnancy.
Yeah, the prey method.
What's it called? The rhythm method.
The rhythm method.
Yeah.
No, I don't know. Because the pill, I don't think the pill was as widely available as it is now. But
gosh, I was just thinking, what if nowadays some people, all the women who have IUDs, because don't those need to be taken out after a certain time?
Yeah.
Yikes. How is that going to be removed if we don't have gynecologists? Could you imagine?
Oh, man.
Probably millions of women.
Mm-hmm.
Yo, what a scary thought.
Yeah. That's another thing. Like, how do you, here comes the topic.
Here we go. What is it?
Sanitary supplies for your period.
I think you go back to literally being on the rag.
Yeah.
You're just going to have to wash it.
You use what you have and you try to get, but once all of that runs out, because they're not going to be manufacturing tampons and pads. Yeah, I think you're right. It's things you got to think about.
Yeah. Woo! Sorry about that. But yeah, no, that, now I'm worried for our sisters. So yeah, that would basically be it. I would say a book, but because the library was still around, I think that would probably be okay.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, just a couple more. What factors of character and circumstance justify Randy's assuming responsibility and authority over Fort Repose? His thought in Chapter 7, when you had the responsibility, you also had the right to command. Is that explanation enough?
Well, he essentially, they hear the order that anybody who has like the military, they're essentially been reactivated. And he has the right to form a militia. So he's following those orders. So that's the circumstance. I think the character of him being very heroic in the way he is and very upstanding and moral is what leads him to be a fair leader.
Mm-hmm.
So it allows that when you had the responsibility, you also had the right to command, to be a positive thing. Because it can be a very positive thing. Some people do need somebody to take charge. However, that could go completely the other direction.
Sure. Well, it's interesting that no one else steps up because there were other people. But it takes him like gathering a volunteer and really leading that wave.
It was like he's Wyatt Earp or something.
Yeah.
And actually, that's the figure that in some ways he reminds me of, that sort of Wyatt, like Gary Cooper type of character.
It's just interesting because you called him a scrub.
I said screw up.
Whatever you said.
The beginning of the novel.
You were quoting TLC and you called
him. He ain't hanging out on the passenger side of his best friend's ride trying to holler at me.
Yes. Right? I mean, do you feel like a scrub could do what he did? I mean, does that make sense that he would have that development? Or are you too hard on him? And do you think that he was always a good leader and it was just he wasn't having lots of opportunities and now he was finally given one?
I think he's making up for a failure in the past because remember he lost an election.
Yeah.
And like that's why I was saying he was kind of the screw up between the two brothers, because Mark's the military guy. Mark's the one, the troop, the one who knows all the things, the one who's the upstanding dad. He's reason, you know, he's the example. And Randy is the failure in some ways. He's not a complete failure. So what he has here is a redemption for that failure earlier in his life.
Yeah. Which I believe actually he lost because of racism.
Yeah, because he was friends with
Is Porky supposed to be like Boss Hogg? But
that's a good. That's what I was picturing, or
jeez, that or guy, the,
or
that,
like a George Wallace.
Yeah, like just a type. Bad guy. But basically, because he was asked by a constituent whether he believed in the Supreme Court, which I assume we were talking about, like integration.
He's like Brown versus Board. Yeah.
So that was his downfall: is that he believed in equal rights.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately.
Yeah. Well, this is the height of the civil rights movement. So,
yeah. Well, I feel like he has. I mean, he is, you know, he's taking his time. He's bird watching. He's having fun. But I think there's just something deep inside of him. Now, maybe it is how you say that he's just this guy, a Gary Stu, maybe. And something has awoken in him and he needs to be this great guy. But I don't know. The way he brings everyone in there and opens up everything and loses his bachelor pad, he seems like a great guy.
Well, he does seem like a very good guy. Yeah. Yeah.
And I would say the catalyst is almost the refusal to bury, because when he pulled a gun, he's like, you will bury or else. I think that was the time he's like, okay, it's... Oh, well, and then Dan, that's another catalyst, because they're like, we need to get rid of these people. Yeah. People are going to hang for this. So, yeah.
This does not come out of nowhere, though. Credit to the writer for having that long burn of an introduction, slow burn of an introduction prior to the bomb going off, because or the bomb being dropped, because we know that he was in the service as well.
Yeah.
So when he starts to be like this, and it's not a heel turn or anything, he's actually just taking order. He's a sheriff for now, right? That's why I said Wyatt Earp. You know, he's the sheriff. It logically tracks, because we knew that he had that inside of him, and he just kind of had, you know, whereas Mark kept going, he just kind of let it go away. But if you had that, you don't completely lose it, and you can snap back to it.
Yeah.
You know, you don't forget that training.
Absolutely. Yeah. So I think that his explanation is enough. I can't remember what his position was, because if he was just like a plebe or a private or something.
I think he was just an enlistee.
It's just said that he's an infantry. Oh, well, it does say he was an officer, though. Infantry officer.
Okay.
So so he has experience leading.
Yes.
But I don't know without him if he would have, like, if someone else would have stepped up looking. Because everyone just, like, stands around that area of town where they post things, it seems, or they mind their own business. But I don't know that anyone else was getting in their own in other people's business. So I think it needed someone to light the fire under everybody else.
Well, and then you do have the whole, like, again, since he lost the election, it's like almost like the realization, oh, we should have chosen you in the first place, right? Yeah. So, yep.
Probably.
Yeah.
You did, before this last one, I think it was you, mention about the salt. The salt that they find. So there's a lack. They've used more salt than they thought. They had a lot. Kids were using it to brush their teeth, which I did not realize was a thing. So that was very interesting.
It's weird.
And then, of course, preserving food. And then just our body needs salt. And so there was definitely a simile, I think, to animals, and that even, you know, predator and prey will be at the same salt lick because that's how much they need it. So they're running out, and then Dan has, in a very intimate and shipper worthy section, Helen has been reading to Dan, and they've been reading these journals that an ancestor has of the Braggs, and he had found some sort of salt paradise, and so they end up going downstream, or upstream, I guess, because it was down on the way back, and find a bunch of crabs, and also not the those bad crabs, but food crabs, and also and also salt. So you asked, which you might believe, it might be a leading question, do you feel like this is a deus ex machina, that it comes out of nowhere to solve our characters' problems?
I think it does, because it's the only way we get a happy ending. It's not a happy, happy ending, but it ends on an upswing that they've all resolved to stay together, which is supposed to be, which I honestly like, is a close to a happy ending, because they've found this community. They don't want to be split up. You know, the military is not going to be treating them very well when they actually get into that. You know, it's going to be kind of a hell. So why would we go to that when we have everything that we want here? And so that there, it ends in an upbeat way, but without them finding that, it's just them. If they didn't find that and they decided to stay, it's kind of a, wow, we're just going to go die together. It's empty. It's almost not nihilistic, but it's kind of like tragic, you know, like we'll just, that we've given up, you know, or we'll keep trying, but it's way more pessimistic. At least this ends on an optimistic note. And I think that all of a sudden we have these things and, oh, look, and food and salt. And it's just, it is a little too convenient.
I see. Well, how you wanted them to die in some way?
I didn't want them to die. I just, it kind of comes out of nowhere.
But I mean, the journal had been introduced earlier. And well, the journal was introduced slightly earlier, but this man was talked about way earlier when in connection to the Braggs. So isn't that enough?
No.
Oh, dear me.
It's just the stuff shows up in a way that is way too convenient for the plot.
Oh, Tom. I don't know what to say. Do you think that Peyton getting some bass is convenient?
No, because she as a character was always like resourceful and she wanted to do the things that the boys were doing and she wasn't allowed. So her having a moment where she goes out on her own and does that makes total sense.
Well, yeah, I don't know what to say. I'm interested in the salt because I feel like no one talks about salt. This is the first time that characters could have died because of a lack of salt. Mm-hmm. It's more like food and stuff, which food was an issue because the fish weren't biting.
Yeah.
But I guess I don't feel as strongly as you do. I think I would have felt more strongly had the military arrived and dropped off bags of salt.
Oh, yeah. That would have been just as that would have been a true deus ex machina because it's God dropping things from the sky.
Yeah.
No, that would have been even worse, actually. The savior comes in, like at least this is them being resourceful and finding their own resource for things. So it tracks with them building their own civilization back together. So I'll give him credit for that. I just thought the timing was too convenient.
Oh, Tom. Okay, well, we'll leave it with this. To what extent does survival of the fittest apply in Fort Repose after the day? What do Randy and the others understand that phrase to mean, and what do you understand it to mean?
I think it takes on a couple of meanings depending on where in Fort Repose you are. You know, to me, survival of the fittest has always been the whole Darwinian principle of adaptation. Mm-hmm. And I think people misinterpret the word fittest to be strongest when that's not the case. It's the person who can adapt. It's the person who is smart enough or sometimes does have the physical capability and strength, but is the most able in that situation. And it's not always the strongest physically. I think very often we confuse that. Now, survival of the fittest, in the case of the people in Randy and his his group, I think he is very much understanding that it is a means of adapting to the new world, and he applies it of those who are the most fit to be out there and doing things are the ones in charge and doing it and putting everybody in a role and taking care of those who need to be taken care of. However, go over to Pistolville, and it's every man for themselves, which is survival of the fittest in that regard, right? You know. So I think we see multiple definitions of it. I actually think that's very well done in the book.
Yeah, I think it's all aspect of a human. I think heart, mind, and muscle, and how someone is able to consider situations and figure out unique solutions for issues. Yes, there will probably be some fighting and being able to survive diseases as well as man dangers. And heart-wise, I think you just have to be cautious in terms of, like we talked about, the Samaritan, because you still want your civilization to survive. So you probably want to take people in and everything, but you have to be cautious with it. So, I would say that is probably true. And I think I used to do this fun – I would consider it fun. end of the AP year in Latin assignment where it was called AP Zombies. And there were six prompts. I think I had three. I might have had more, but three for Caesar and three for the Aeneid. And it was basically like taking something that actually happened in the stories and then putting a zombie bent to it, like maybe Dido is a zombie and Aeneas lands, like, what do you do? Or maybe it might have actually been Dido, and then Aeneas is zombies and what do you do as Dido? And one of the requirements for, actually, Tom, you helped me with this because I, using a mentor text, because I remember you did something similar.
Yeah, the zombie role-playing game.
Absolutely,
that they used to do for
sophomores.
Yeah.
A mandatory piece of that is you have to have a squad that are made up of the actual characters in that portion, and they should have a job. And so I think if we looked at our community within the Bragg household, each of them has a particular function.
Yeah.
Some of them, of course, might fall into the patriarchy and some might nudge against it, but they all have a part to play. And even Two-Tone, I think, gets, because he ends up, his alcoholism helps, because they end up making moonshine,
yeah,
which is a tradable commodity.
Yeah.
Which is great. So, yes.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, that was... for me, it was, we read a part of World War Z and I gave you coordinates. You looked up the coordinates. This is where you were. You built your team. And then I gave you your starting point and what you had with you. It was the story. You had to write the story of you surviving the first stages of the zombie. Like, how did you get to safety from there? And the only other requirement was that one of you had to survive at least. You could all survive, but nobody, it wasn't, you needed somebody to be able to tell the tale, and you just went from there, and they were just locations like all over the place. Yeah, so it was, I always had fun with that. I was actually just talking to my student teacher about that the other day. It's like,
yeah,
I have,
it is. See, it's a fun assignment.
I still have all the stuff. I just can't figure out a way to do it in an English class nowadays. I'm like, it's just too much stuff that I have. Yeah.
You could do it with, what's that really sad novel by Toni Morrison?
Beloved.
Yeah.
I don't know if I do.
I'm just kidding. That'd be the worst novel to try to adapt that.
Yeah. The Odyssey might work with something like that. Lord of the Flies works with something like that as well.
Imagine Circe was turning his men into zombies.
Mm.
Okay, well, Tom, we've reached the end. Of course, there's always more to chat about in terms of novels, but we're going to, I think, end it there. Would you consider this required reading?
You know, I would, because dystopian post-apocalyptic fiction is still pretty popular. You know, it waxes and wanes based on, like, what the trends are in, especially like in young adult literature. But when you have like the Cormac McCarthy stuff and you have the Hunger Games or you have other books that depict these sorts of things, much like I would say you need to read Lord of the Flies as a foundational text, I think this is another one, because I don't think that this strikes me as one of the very first to be written about a scenario like this. And therefore, I think you need to go back to it and see its origin point. And I also think it's a vital story about like people actually coming together in a way that's realistic, because they're not like rising up against the fictional government. They're not going after Big Brother, and it's not as and it doesn't end as bleak. Mm-hmm. The road is bleak.
Cannibalism, another thing that doesn't
so
take
bleak.
Place.
So there is a little more light here, and I think it's a good contrast to some of the other more pessimistic views. So yeah, I think it fits really, really well in the subgenre, and I think it's a required text if you're going through it.
Yeah, I would agree. I think honestly it's pretty relevant and realistic, not to like fearmonger, but just like, oh, like these are situations that could happen. And the fact that the author was like steeped in military and strategic situations.
Yeah, there's something very Tom Clancy about this guy, isn't there?
Yeah, so he knows what he's talking about. The players might be different, maybe not, I don't know. And yeah, I think it might be good to, I mean, I'm not gonna say go out and be one of those preppers necessarily, but maybe like gardening, why don't you take up gardening and like know things about soil and seeds and things like that. And again, yeah, I think another relevancy is just like the lack of importance of racial differences. Yeah. Like it just, it's
a little progressive for its time.
Oh, for sure. For sure. Yeah.
Mockingbird's the following year. So this is a little bit progressive for its time. That's good.
Well, there you have it.
All right. We do have one piece of feedback, a couple of comments from Robert Ward, our Scholastic book buddy over on Facebook. So I'll read them first. He says, a special episode focused solely on covers such as favorite or least when that I'm going to put that in our document that we keep for ideas for specials, because that's a fun topic. It's going looking at different covers of books and talking about the ones we really like and what we don't like about a certain cover. We could talk about like how for a while, especially lately in the last couple of years, like there seems to be the same cover for books in certain genres by certain types of writers, mm-hmm. which happens from time to time. Like fun romance books always seem to have certain elements. There's the whole sans serif text with blobs of color, you know, like, so that would be a really, really fun thing to research and to talk about. So we'll put a pin in that. So thank you, Robert. His other comment is this. So he says, Stella may be reading a lot of smut, but honestly, I think that's awesome. I have a modest collection of old smut paperbacks that are even worse than what she is reading. Those are classics. The modern day equivalent is basically online writing depositories like Literotica, just without explicit drawing covers or nude photo covers. These were properly published and could cover any range of obscene or taboo topics, which I think segues really well into my question of next episode being episode 90, which is a special topics episode. Stella, what are we talking about next month?
Oh, gosh. Well, Tom emailed me and gave a list of potentials, which I'm aware of the ones that we've been building.
You are pinning this on me.
No, I'm setting it up. I'm setting it up. So he sent me a list of potentials. And this one was like recently talked about, which of course is where this comment is coming from. And I'm like waist deep in smut right now. I can read probably one a week, maybe one in a weekend. Who knows? So I was just like, Tom, let's just talk about smut. And because it's, you know, it'd be funny if Tom were to lead that discussion. Oh, but I think I'm going to fight him for it and be the leader on this.
I think I'm going to let you be the leader on this. I think you would be a better leader for this.
Well, Tom, he already showed his ignorance by saying that those cutesy covers are fun romances, because those cutesy covers within, they belie a dirty darkness.
I think we're also going to discuss the definition, our definitions of smut, and absolutely the levels.
Correct. Levels, definition, kind of the trajectory, its popularity now, where it's gone. And I do want to say, now, Tom, we can kind of, you can stop me or we can hash this out later. I really want to put an explicit label on this episode. I was thinking about this today when I was walking, because mm-hmm. I just feel like I don't want to be using hedging language and hemming and hawing and be like, her, you know what, and his, you know what. I think I'm just going to be saying what I'm actually, like, what we're talking about. And I think it's just going to be easier that way. And so just to be upfront, yeah, like, if you don't want to hear things about genitalia or bodily fluids, I would just skip this episode. It's definitely going to be more than that, but I do, because Della's, I think we need to talk curse about, like you said, the degree of what we're talking about and kind of, I think, historically, like, how it's gone. So,
you know, I was thinking about this today myself, because I was trying to think about what I wanted to do for episode 91, and then I was like, yeah, we're definitely gonna have to put probably a content warning and a explicit tag on episode 90, because I would not want to, what's the point of dancing around this? You know, we don't have to get vulgar, but you want to have a frank discussion about sex, sexuality, and how it's portrayed in literature.
Right.
If you have to go there, we have to go there.
Absolutely.
So,
and expectations, I think, of who's reading it and maybe their expectations of what sex is like and what they're looking for in a partner. And so I do want to like have some of these phrases of like, what are some of these male main characters saying to these girls? And, you know, what do you think about that? I will also say that I asked Tom if he wanted a recommendation of one of the books I had read, just so he could see like the levels that I have read. So if you listeners would like something, I just sent him like a couple that were all different genres. But I mean, like L. Kennedy, Stephanie Archer, you could just like pick up anything. You know, hockey's really big, so we'll probably talk about that. Yeah, so I'm excited about it. I think it'll be really interesting. But yeah, it's definitely going to be explicit, so be aware.
You know, like I said, we're going to spend some time planning this out. It does not necessarily need to stay in the heteronormative realm either.
No.
So, I mean, it might primarily dwell there to a certain extent because a lot of it, at least its history from what we know, there has been a lot of it. Mm-hmm. And we are going to do our best to also treat that sensitively.
Yeah.
You know, even if we are pointing out some of the worst tropes of the past –
yeah.
Because there were some that, like, you know, were definitely exploitative. It's not a joke or laughable that there would be a steamy sex scene between two men in a novel. You know, we're not laughing like we're in junior high. We're going to have fun.
Oh, yes.
We are going to treat it with the dignity that it deserves. So, so come back in a month for required reading after dark.
I know. Tom and Stella go blue.
Until then, thank you very much for listening and take care.
And please, if someone offers you jewelry, don't take it.
Or at least bring a Geiger counter.
Yeah, no doubt.
Good night.
Bye. Thanks for listening to Required Reading with Tom and Stella, which is brought to you by Two True Freaks. That's Two True Freaks. If you're interested in learning more about the books we've read or want to comment on the episode, follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/requiredreadingwithtomandstella.
If you would like to email us to comment on the episode or continue our discussion, you can reach us at requiredreadingcast@gmail.com. We will read every email we get on future episodes.
We're looking for more visibility, so if you liked this episode or the show in general, why not leave us a review in iTunes? Thanks again for listening, and come back next month for our next episode.
A scrub is a guy that thinks he's fly and is also known as a buster. Always talking about what he wants and just sits on his broke ass soul.
No,
I don't want your number,
no.
I don't wanna give you mine and
no.
I don't wanna meet you nowhere,
no.
Don't want none of your time and
no. I don't want no scrub. A scrub is a guy that can't get no love from me. Hanging on the passenger side of his best friend's ride, trying to holler at me. I don't want no scrub. A scrub is a guy that can't get no love from me. Hanging on the passenger side of his best friend's ride, trying to holler at me.
Well, the scrub's checking me, but his game is kinda weird. And I know that he cannot approach me, cause I'm looking like glass and he's looking like trash. Can't get with a deadbeat ass. So
no,
I don't want your number,
no.
I don't wanna give you mine and
no.
I don't wanna meet you nowhere,
no.
Don't want none of your time.
No, I don't want no scrub. A scrub is a guy that can't get no love from me. Hanging out the passenger side of his best friend's ride, trying to holler at me. Don't show love. Oh yes, son, I'm talking to you. Wanna get with me with no money? Oh no, I don't want no scrub. No scrub. No, no scrub. No, 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 no
scrub. No, no.
No, I don't want no scrub. A scrub is a guy that can't get no love.
to holler at.